work with Precognitive Dissonance on Anomaly Radio. Hey, I got it right that time. And we've got our guest Nick Redfern on the line. Nick, you're with us?
Yep, I'm still here.
Right. Well, welcome back, everybody. Nick, I wanted to ask you something real quick before we move on about Cannock Chase and I suppose the English parks and wild areas in general. Is there anything like the Forestry Service or the National Park Service that we have here in the U.S.? Do you have park rangers, as it were?
Yeah, they're what the forest, what's called the Forestry Commission, and, you know, the guys who go around and just make sure everything's okay and, you know, if there are any injured animals, you know, like a deer's been hit by a car, that sort of thing, they'll deal with that, make sure that there's no, you know, fires, that sort of thing. There are a number of camping areas, official camping areas, where in most woods, you know, where you can camp, they'll make sure everything's okay out there. And a lot of forests, including the Cannock Chase, do have like a Forestry Commission office where, you know, you can go and get advice on where to stay. And if they know where you are, they'll come round and just patrol around, make sure you're okay at night, you haven't got into any difficulties or anything like that. So, yeah, you know, in most forests, well, if not all forests, big ones, you'll find three or four people that's their full-time job is just tending and looking after the, you know, the forest and the wildlife and making sure, you know, people aren't starting fires and that sort of thing.
Hmm. Well, we've reserved this hour to go in-depth with our guest Nick Redfern about not his latest book, but one of his more recent books, there being so many to choose from to talk about, but this one being probably his most controversial by far, and that being Body Snatchers in the Desert, The Horrible Truth at the Heart of the Roswell Story. Now, I got to start out by saying, you know, I grew up, like so many folks who are interested in UFOs, you know, being indoctrinated into the myth of crash saucers, government cover-ups, pickled aliens, and those led to some pretty wacky stories in the 80s that ended up being the mainstay of modern ufology, the idea of agreements between the United States government and military with these alleged alien species to give them carte blanche to abduct and mutilate the cattle and abduct humans and perform these experiments. And
all these led to the X-Files and yeah, not exactly a renaissance, but perhaps a much wider public consciousness of things paranormal.
And it influenced many aspects of culture. I mean, obviously there's a whole group of people now that believe these sorts of ideas. One of my favorite commentators on all things consciousness related, Terrence McKenna, was always warning people to indoctrinate themselves against the myth of salvation from an extraterrestrial other. Because he thought that we were kind of being set up for that, and that the phenomena, whatever it is, could manifest such a mass sighting, but that it ultimately would go away and leave us all flabbergasted and clutching for some meaningfulness. And you know, I've gone through my own arc of belief and disbelief, and turned, you know, 180 degrees and 360 degrees, and gone in several different directions on exploring the true nature of UFOs. And one of the things that folks like Jacques Vallée and Whitley Strieber and John Keel and many others, that fine researchers that I really respect, and led me to this idea that, well, maybe it's not as simple as the idea of extraterrestrials, that this phenomenon seems to have been here with us on this planet for a lot longer than the modern UFO era, and that, in fact, that made me question the Roswell case in particular, because it didn't seem to fit. I mean, later years, that there have come to be these competing theories, and some of which are pretty exotic, but not as exotic as some of the ideas that actually, I think, help us understand true UFOs. But in my exploration of alternative theories, I became aware of things like the CIA's MK Ultra mind control research and human experimentation and all these other angles to weird phenomena that led me in different directions than a purely extraterrestrial interpretation of things like the Roswell incident. So I was ripe for a different take on this. But even 10 plus years ago, when I was hearing the beginnings of this idea that we're going to hear about Nick researching and Body Snatchers, I was still skeptical of that. But my main point is to say that the Roswell case never seemed to fit the quote-unquote stranger aspects of UFO phenomena. And also, I wanted to comment, I just saw a post of Nick's to the UFO updates list from a couple of days ago, where this kind of gets to what I was talking about, the influence of UFOs and alien culture on things like, you know, rave culture, you know, just became replete with UFO alien imagery for a while there. But, Nick, you talk about in this post the possibility of what if Roswell was proven to not be extraterrestrial and how that could radically affect, obviously, the people who've been researching this for a long time. I don't even know where to begin with this, but
as far as to take it from there, if you like, you know, before actually getting into the theories and so on, if, you know, my personal view is if Roswell was proven not to be extraterrestrial, I think, you know, the thing to stress here is whether or not we'll ever get definitive proof of what happened at Roswell. You know, certainly we've got a lot of testimony, stories, accounts, etc. Whether we'll actually get 100% proof, I just don't know. But if we did, you know, I think, you know, one of the debates I had on updates was the extent to which Roswell influences or can be considered like one of the cornerstones of ufology, and to what extent ufology in its current form would survive if Roswell didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as I pointed out in my update replies, the fact that, you know, if Roswell collapses, people think, oh, it's just one case, which in some respects it is. You know, there actually are a lot of good cases out there to suggest that there is a genuine unknown presence amongst us from, you know, somewhere, if you like. But if Roswell collapses, and that's the best investigated crashed UFO story, people are then inevitably going to think, well, you know, what about all these other crash stories? Does that mean if Roswell's the most thoroughly investigated and that didn't stand up, does that just mean all the rest are going to collapse? Then from there you have, you know, the things you talked about earlier, Hangar 18, pickled aliens, treaties, underground bases, that sort of thing. All that collapses. Back engineering, the story of people like Colonel Corso. So it isn't just the case. It's the domino effect of all the different strands that spread outward from the original Roswell story.
The mythos
that
all those things are the stars in the constellation.
Yeah, and when the main one goes out, the rest of them do as well.
But also, as you're kind of also saying, I mean, you know, just because you prove one dollar bill is fake doesn't mean all dollar bills are fake.
No, that's the thing I stress. You know, I'm firmly convinced, as you know from some of my posts at UFO Mystic that I do with Greg Bishop, I was like you when I was sort of, you know, a teenager, as a kid. I got into the subject reading the books of people like Kehoe and Stringfield, very much sort of nuts and bolts type books. The further I delved into it, I found that, for me at least, there were two things actually at work. I came less and less to the idea that there were nuts and bolts literal aliens, and more to the idea that there was some sort of unexplained, unknown presence amongst us that's possibly always been with us, but that kind of changes and molds and manifests itself in different ways.
Yeah.
And it's tied in with paranormal phenomena. And there's also the fact, the other aspect of the phenomenon, I believe, is the way in which the government uses it and manipulates it to hide its own activities. I think you have those two categories rather than just one clearly delineated nuts and bolts, literal aliens angle, shall we say.
I'm going to say that's kind of the other side of the Mobius coin that is the Roswell story, is how the government has more or less reinvented the case three or four, five times now. I've been kind of reviewing old shows this week, and one of the things that we touched on was something prompted by something you'd said at UFO Mystic back in January or February, or more just a sense I had reading them, that you felt that none of these explanations had to be mutually exclusive.
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting, because it's like you look into a lot of these cases, a lot of these incidents, then, you know, they could swing in different directions. And does that mean if we rule one thing out that, you know, we have to automatically rule another one in? I'm not sure. I mean, you know, you look at the whole issue of what was going on in 1947, for example, there were some genuinely weird UFO encounters. On the other hand, there's absolutely no doubt that there was a whole range of, you know, German scientists brought over with classified files on advanced technology, you know, working out in Los Alamos and White Sands, you know, brought over through the paperclip program. So it almost seems to be the case that what kind of stumps us and, you know, frazzles us in terms of trying to find the answers is the fact that we are faced often with conflicting data, but that could lead in different directions, if you like. And I think that's why, you know, it's been so hard to prove definitively the real story in things like Maury Island, even, you know, as to where the truth lies. And of course, then the passage of time and people getting older and dying, you know, when you don't have the official files and you find that, you know, the youngest person who was involved in Roswell is like now in the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
It's, you know, that really sort of hits home the stark reality of how, you know, in another 10 years, it's going to be probably impossible to actually investigate something like Roswell anymore unless, you know, somebody slips up and something surfaces in a government archive or something like that, because there won't be anyone to talk to.
Well, so let's get right into the meat of your book. And why don't you, give us a little sampling of what you're going to be talking about at Roswell's 60th anniversary.
Okay, well, the lectures at the Roswell UFO Festival on the weekend of, I think it's the 6th to the 9th, something like that, or the 6th to the 8th. Anyway, it's that weekend. And the official website is roswellufofestival.com. And I'll be there, Greg Bishop, a lot of other UFO researchers, also Dean Hagland, who has played Langley on The X-Files,
yeah.
He's going to be there, and a few others. And it's Mike Heiser, he's another speaker, who's going to be talking about his researches into Roswell and his theories that also link Roswell with down-to-earth human experimentation. And he's delving, I think, more into the German paperclip angle, which I touch upon in my book, but not to a great extent. But basically, as everybody knows, that the traditional scenario of Roswell is that some sort of craft came down or exploded in the air, and the debris was found by this Rancher MacRazzle, taken into town. The military said first it was a flying disc, then no, it was a weather balloon. And then there were stories that there were possibly one or two other locations where other things had come down, one being bodies of some sort and possibly a semi-intact vehicle or other materials at least. And then, of course, when the weather balloon story was put into place, you know, the media back then bought it, didn't question the official story, and it literally pretty much vanished into obscurity, apart from a few occasional mentions. Frank Edwards actually mentioned it in his Flying Saucers Serious Business book in the mid-60s. But beyond that, and beyond, you know, a few similar tales like the Aztec story, which again just sort of surfaced briefly and then vanished in the mid-50s, there wasn't really that much attention paid to crashed UFOs until the late 70s, early 80s, and Roswell really came to the fore again with the books of Berlitz and Moore, then Randall and Schmidt later on, and it's sort of been pretty much, you know, at the forefront and the cornerstone of modern day, not just ufology, but the more the cover-up, the government secrecy angle, shall we say. And it's the one case I personally believe more than any other that the outright ETH, extraterrestrial hypothesis believers, that for them is the one that offers the most hope of finding definitive physical proof that real, literal aliens are with us. So it's a case, you know, that everything sits upon. And you know, I was a firm believer for years that, you know, aliens had crashed at Roswell. The thing that sort of turned me around was back in the sort of mid-1990s, 96, 97, I began to hear stories, a couple of insiders in England, and also Popular Mechanics ran an article that delved into the idea that maybe, you know, it wasn't a flying saucer, it wasn't a weather balloon, and certainly wasn't a mogul balloon, this classified balloon that the government said was used to monitor for Soviet atomic bomb explosions. And certainly the project existed. The question is whether or not one of these balloons crashed at Roswell. And, you know, there were these veiled rumors, if you like, and dark stories suggesting that, yes, a balloon or balloons were involved in various aspects of the Roswell story, but it was far darker and controversial in the sense that what was actually going on was that the government was utilizing prisoners of war and in some cases even handicapped people literally taken from medical facilities where they wouldn't be missed and using them, exposing them in high altitude exposure tests and even experiments using huge balloons with prototype gondolas that could be detached in emergencies and just seeing, you know, if these experiments would work, but let's not use anyone who isn't expendable, you know, let's not use military guys, let's just use anyone that nobody's going to miss. And the stories that I got from collectively about six or seven people were that roughly between May 47 and possibly August, there were seven or eight controversial experiments undertaken in the New Mexico desert in which various experiments were undertaken using large balloon arrays, huge balloon arrays, some of which had gondolas attached to them, one of which reportedly had a detachable glider-type aircraft. And the plan was that, you know, in a warfare scenario, or probably more of an espionage scenario, one of these huge balloons could be flown at very high altitude over a foreign nation to avoid radar. And then a spy plane could be detached from it, a lightweight glider-type craft. And reportedly, they were undertaking a lot of these experiments in New Mexico. Now, that in itself, you know, the fact that you're test-flying prototype aircraft or high-altitude exposure experiments isn't necessarily something that you would keep secret. The secret appears to be the case that one, as I said, one of the theories or one of the piece of data that was put forward to me was that a number of the people used, as I said, weren't military volunteers or anything like that. They were literally people taken from medical facilities, asylums, and more controversially, Japanese prisoners of war brought over at the end of the Second World War, and even people who'd been used unwittingly, I should say, by the Japanese in their controversial Unit 731 biological warfare program. And that it was this fact, the fact that these were controversial human experiments using guinea pigs, for want of a better term, that it was this that had to be hidden at all costs. Because there actually wasn't any sort of big advanced technology at work here. It was just the military in an early era trying to understand the effects of high-altitude exposure and test-flying new and prototype aircraft and test-flying escape systems and things like that. So that, broadly speaking, is the story that was given to me. And so what I did was to delve into the witness testimony and met these people on a number of occasions. And one of the things that the book, for the most part, tells the story of what I was told. What it doesn't actually go into to a great deal, which for me at least was equally of interest, was the nature of the interview. You know, it was literally, not exaggerating now, it was literally a case of receiving a phone call and saying, and somebody saying, you know, you're required, if you want to learn more about this story, to be at a particular Denny's on the road to Austin. You know, literally on the road to Austin, and not once on the way to Waco. By 10 o'clock on Thursday morning and look out for an elderly guy sitting in the corner booth. That's literally how it happened. But the publisher didn't really want to go down the path of making it a personal story. They just wanted it kind of, you know, the facts and the data. So it was a case of me sitting down with these elderly men, in one case an elderly woman, who related broadly what I've said to you, that they were aware that there'd been these controversial human experiments in the deserts using high-altitude balloons, and that when they went wrong, and inadvertently, the one case that led to the Roswell incident, as it's become known, that in a worst-case scenario, a member of the public actually got there before the military did, that then required cover stories being put into place. And they were of the opinion that this was where the whole issue of hiding controversial military experiments behind the UFO banner began. And at that time, it was more of just an emergency procedure to put into place to hide the truth. But over the years, it was, you know, became more sophisticated, if you like. And so, you know, I listened to these stories, found them very, very interesting, certainly. didn't really know what to make of it. You know, was it a case that, well, this is just another cover story, which isn't impossible, but the one thing that makes me think it isn't a cover story is that, you know, the government has had this mobile balloon theory and the crash test dummy theory for the bodies in place. Well, the mobile balloon's been in place since 94. The crash test dummies have been in place since 97. So why deliberately bring another theory forward that would make the mogul and the crash test dummies seem like a lie? Do you see what I mean? It wouldn't make sense to introduce a new cover story when they already have this quite acceptable cover story from their perspective. And, you know, the fact that these people had nothing to gain from coming forward really opened my eyes to the idea that, well, you know, maybe this could be the truth. And so I delved into it more and began to find evidence. Some files that I've been discussing just recently on updates in the last couple of days, actually got hold of official files showing at the Oak Ridge installation in Tennessee, where ironically one of the witnesses, an old lady I interviewed for the book, actually worked in the
Black Widow.
Black Widow, yeah. And she told me that bodies are being brought to there, in some cases in like a very mangled condition. Some were handicapped people. Others just look like normal Japanese people, but who've been obviously pummeled in some sort of high altitude fall. And she related this account to me. Literally in the last, well, just very recently, I've got hold of files from Oak Ridge that show in the summer of 47 the results of a number of, I guess, in-depth studies involving radiation experiments were undertaken on a number of people suffering from various forms of dwarfism. And these were all forwarded to Oak Ridge. I actually have these files now. They date literally from July 1947 and June 47.
Wow.
And the document is dated September. And it was circulated with a whole range of people at Oak Ridge. One of the people suffering from a particular type of dwarfism had progeria. Progeria is a rapid aging syndrome in which the body doesn't grow properly. It stays at like a reduced height. And the people have enlarged bald heads. Now, it doesn't take a genius to work out that small bodies, enlarged bald heads, is a classic example of what people said they saw out in the desert at Roswell. And, you know, I pointed out to somebody on updates the other day, what are the chances of radiation experiments involving large-headed dwarfs being undertaken in the summer of 47 and large-headed alien dwarfs crashing in the desert in the same period,
right? And the convergence of the balloons and possible flying wing, flying disc shaped aeroforms.
Nick, these recent reports that you uncovered, do they cite a geographical location for these studies? Is it,
well, this is the thing. I mean, what I know from the files is that various tests were undertaken at various places around the U.S. and Oak Ridge appeared to be the central point where the material evidence was going. That's the problem. You know, that's the problem with this story in some respects, not in terms of credibility, but in terms of the fact that a lot of people were involved and different people were doing different studies and different analyses. I think, you know, it seems to be the case that everybody perceives it as all having occurred in New Mexico because that's where the story leaked out. What we have to realize is the aspects of the story that didn't leak out were the ones that didn't get uncovered because they happened elsewhere. I mean, I'll give you a good example. Going through the files at Oak Ridge, when I was looking through these files on dwarfism, what I actually found were, this is actually a little bit after Roswell, but it gives you a kind of flavor of what was going on there, files from Oak Ridge in 1949, where people who were working on radical designs for prototype atomic-powered aircraft, which actually never really got off the ground to any great extent, but they were doing feasibility studies. There's actually a document which is written in all seriousness from one of the doctors at Oak Ridge saying, is there any way we could approach a local prison and get some prisoners who we could, you know, use in some of these prototype nuclear aircraft experiments and expose them to the nuclear pile and see what happens to them? You know, just ask matter-of-factly.
And that's odd. That quote is eerily reminiscent of the one that went to Der Fuhrer that you also quote in the book.
Yeah.
Some years prior to the start of the Second World War.
Yeah, you know, they said, can you get some specimens or something like that?
It's one of those things. It's a compelling book in a lot of ways. And 10, 15 years ago, you know, I think my first reaction would have been a very knee-jerk, how dare you, sir. Now I'm less certain. It's one of those, I can't really look at it and say, well, this is simply something that the United States government would not have countenanced, because I grew up, one, with the Cold War, and two, in the 70s, was when the first revelations about the MKUltra experiments came out. Those were fairly well documented some years before, but receiving a lot less press coverage at the time, and for many years subsequent, was the extremely long span of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. And there's something that I'm less well informed about, but I understand it's fairly well documented, is in this country and in Canada, the essentially forced sterilization of Native Americans on the various reservations.
Well, and low-scoring citizens well into the 70s, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
IQ scores, I mean.
It's one of those, I can't simply say, well, this couldn't have happened. Mm.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, Craig, when you talk about, you know, the government's doing this or the government allowing that, I'm not entirely sure, and this is actually something I've picked up on before with people at updates. From what the people I interviewed were telling me, it's not entirely certain as to what extent the, quote, government knew what was going on. It seems to be that it was almost like cabals and, you know, these higher-up people in the military who brought over the Japanese and the German scientists. Really, almost like an archaic version of a black project, you know, rather than getting official funding and Harry Truman or somebody signing off on the document.
Mm-hmm. That's something that was kind of a little bit of a bright spot late in the book. You allude to these experiments essentially being shut down once knowledge of them had reached a certain level.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, people have said to me, you know, as far as these experiments are concerned, how is it that we don't know about them? And I think it is quite a viable and acceptable theory, if the story is true, and it isn't disinformation, that, if you're actually talking about something that's sort of 7 or 8 experiments involving high-altitude balloons, there may actually have been a minimum of paperwork kept in terms of the build-up. Probably the main things that would have been put on paper would have been the analysis of how the people were affected afterwards. You know, to what extent, I would seriously be surprised if, you know, somebody had actually been foolish enough to put on paper and say, you know, please go to the nearest mental asylum and bring us 5 people who we can use in a high-altitude balloon experiment. Why do that? You know, just make a couched, cryptic phone call instead and say along the lines of, we need 5 people for the project, that sort of thing.
Well, again, I flash back to the stories we have of the Nazis and the concentration camps, always using euphemisms to cover up what was actually going on, and so that there wasn't really a very detailed paper trail in some cases.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the important thing that a lot of UFO researchers tend to overlook is you have to look not just at the UFO sightings in 47 and Roswell, you have to look what else was going on. For example, as I said, hundreds of German scientists brought up with the paperclip operation. At the end of the war, a lot of the Japanese government's Unit 731 biological warfare files and personnel brought over and actually given basically protection from prosecution. You know, a lot of weird stuff going on, you know, V-2 rockets being tested, Los Alamos. You know, it was a completely different era from sort of 1944-45 even. And then, you know, in the middle of all this, you have these stories about, that we can verify, you know, the human radiation experiment scandals that kicked off in this same period.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at it collectively, it isn't that far out. And I think today, you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't want to hear this because it makes it sound like we're unable to solve Roswell, but one of the things I've pointed out to people is if this wasn't an officially sanctioned project in the sense that a lot of people knew about it, and it was more of like a black project and, you know, doing things out in the desert at military bases with the Germans and the Japanese that were brought over, if that is the case, then maybe destroying the files, burning or destroying half a dozen balloons and burying or burning, you know, 20 or 30 guinea pig bodies, it wouldn't be that difficult. It's not a huge, complex conspiracy like a real crashed UFO or an alien body would be. You know, it would actually be, ironically, very easy to hide. And, you know, if, in a worst-case scenario, it may well be the case that the government of today might actually suspect or even know, in some respect, what happened, but may actually be like us, not have access to the files because nothing is really left. It might be institutional memory that, well, you know, we're pretty sure that's what happened, but there's no way we're going to tell people. You know, we'll just say it was a spy balloon or something. I actually think, if it, you know, if it was a real UFO, there's no way that material evidence would be destroyed. If it was a classified experiment that was semi-illegal, arguably everything could be destroyed. And 60 years on, you know, where do you find it apart from these few fragmentary files like the Oak Ridge ones I talked about that seem to be at the periphery of what happened rather than the crux of the real incident, shall we say?
Well, that's kind of the reason why I was asking about the nature of the Oak Ridge files is that, you know, it occurs to me there were also two enormous radiological events just 2 years prior to Roswell. Mm. That would have produced a host of sample cases. And I find myself wondering if some of the cases from Hiroshima and Nagasaki might not have been conflated somehow.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, that's again one of the things, as I said, about how the world has suddenly changed in that period, 44, 45, through to about 49. There were so many different things going on, you know, so many different fingers in the pie, so to speak. That is what makes, you know, that whole area sort of or time period, a very sort of grey time period in terms of clarity concerning anything, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's so hard to answer the question. I mean, people say to me, are you 100% convinced? And, you know, I can never be 100% convinced. I can never be sure that the people I interviewed weren't part of some weird psychological warfare project. I mean, one theory that was put to me was the fact that these people may earnestly believe the theory, but perhaps they were fed it 40 or 50 years ago as a cover story, which the government ultimately decided not to use, and that they read the files later on thinking they were real. Now, I don't dispute that couldn't happen, but my argument against that is why, if you're going to have a cover story, why have such a controversial one that you say that you did diabolical experiments on handicapped people?
Right. That would seem...
That's counterproductive almost.
Yeah,
well,
it is
counterproductive.
I mean, the revelation about aliens, as much as people might think that would be your paradigm shattering, in some ways, it's just like, okay, that's nothing compared to the idea that your own government, you know, would do this kind of torturous stuff.
No, what that would also do, it would make people look into the case even deeper, which you would think the last thing the government would want. And I think, unfortunately, I have to say this from the UFO research community's perspective, unfortunately, although the book, you know, got widely criticized by the community, a lot of it, I know from reading the nature of the reviews, was purely and simply because people didn't want that to be the truth. That is what a lot of it came down to, is we don't, you know, they didn't want Roswell to be anything other than alien because, you know, of what it would mean, the implications.
I have to confess, when Roswell first started to creep into my consciousness, I was kind of baffled by it because I won't say I favor one theory over another. The ETH is the most attractive of the lot to me because it's the most fascinating. It's the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about, for the longest time, the very idea of UFO crashes, period, to me, seemed ludicrous simply because we were talking about races, cultures that had crossed interstellar space. And that's not something I see brought up too terribly often in ufology, is the sophistication, the technological sophistication a culture would have to achieve that.
Well, you know,
you know, and they came all this way to just fall out of the sky?
Yeah.
And then make no effort to recover the craft or have no contingency for that?
Well, you know, that's one of the, what I was actually going to mention, and that's one of the most important things that so many researchers either don't comment on or don't realize, you know, presumably these things, because they've never landed on, you know, the White House lawn outside Buckingham Palace, they're staying covert and away from us. They don't want open contact. Yet when one of their most advanced vehicles reportedly crashes near, you know, sensitive military installations where they could easily be taken to, you're quite right, no attempt was ever made to retrieve the bodies or to retrieve the power plants or anything like that. They just let it fall into our hands, which to me is bizarre. You know, you would imagine that if they don't want to make open contact and have reasons for not wanting to talk with us on an open level, they're certainly not going to give us the opportunity to, you know, learn the secrets of interstellar travel and warp drives or something like that. Yet apparently, if they crashed, that's precisely what they did do.
Well, as I said earlier, the Roswell event doesn't seem to fit so much of the rest of UFO lore outside of the cold post-World War II crash saucer mythos. But the one way it does fit is the tricksterish aspect where we're left scratching our heads going, well, what the heck is the truth? Which of these competing theories, you know, is more accurate, though, like, more and more. I do actually lean towards this, and this interpretation as a possible explanation. You've alluded to, in some of your UFOmystic.com blog posts recently, information you're coming across, have been coming across, regarding military government insiders or just retired folks who have ideas about the nature of the supposed ultra, extra, whatever, these others. And it's a pretty metaphysical, spooky, religious...
This is actually something for another book I'm working on. The idea that, you know, there's another angle to Roswell, that a lot of it, and one of the things I'm stressing, is that this is very much based upon belief systems of the people that believe it, basically. The idea is that there, or not so much the idea, but I know for a fact, is that there are certain people, some of them retired, many formerly from the Defense Intelligence Agency, who, although they worked in the official world, basically had sort of like a semi-official, like they created like a gentleman's type club or something like that, for want of a better term, where they would meet up and discuss issues of interest, like, for example, UFOs. And the theory that they came to, or the conclusion, was that these things weren't secret weapons, they weren't literal alien technology. Rather, they were something paranormal, and as some of the people described it, almost like demonic in origin. And actually came to the conclusion that, you know, the whole UFO alien abduction angle is simply an outgrowth of things like Aleister Crowley's manifestations of Lamb or ancient Babylonian tales of encounters with demons, and that the UFO motif of today was just an outgrowth of it. And these things were literally here to, you know, steal people's souls and bring on Armageddon. And I know for a fact that a number of these people actually accept the theory that Roswell was basically some sort of doorway having been opened by Crowley's disciple Jack Parsons. Now, you know, this is a bizarre story, but I know that this story is believed by certain people. You know, undertaking rites and rituals and literally allowed some sort of demonic entity that utilizes technology, you know, doesn't sort of live in, you know, some underground place full of flames and pitchforks, but actually is a demonic type entity that utilizes technology possibly in similar ways to that we do. And that's, you know, but it has its roots in the paranormal, shall we say. Now, personally, I don't buy that theory, but what I'm doing is pointing out to people that, you know, I'm basically chronicling the story that these people that have held positions of influence in the military do believe. But again, you know, it comes down to the question, do they have proof? or are they of that mindset where they come to that conclusion? You know, it's debatable as to whether or not the fact that they're in the official world actually has any bearing on whether the theory has any truth to it, if you see what I mean. You know, does it matter if they're in the official world if the information didn't come from the official world but comes from their belief systems having been brought up in sort of a rigid religious background or something? Or, you know, I mean, one or two of the people have said that, yeah, they read files, sort of theoretical files at least, talking about how this idea was bandied about in the early 70s, the idea that, you know, these entities were more sinister and that they were almost deceiving us, and that the government had come to this horrific conclusion that they were literally dealing with demons masquerading as aliens to, you know, engineer the end of the world, if you like. But, you know, I mean, that's the big problem with Roswell when you talk about the trickster element, is that there are so many theories. I mean, Max Tonis, a good friend of mine, Max, working on this book right now, you may know, about so-called crypto-terrestrials.
Yeah.
The idea that perhaps in remote parts of the Earth, there are other intelligent species, or perhaps offshoots of the human race, that are hiding from us, and that perhaps existed long before us, had advanced technologies, and that maybe, you know, they're declining, and maybe there's just a few handfuls left, and that maybe they crashed at Roswell, and, you know, they showed themselves by mistake, and that they're responsible, and, you know, they're kind of like a shadow race, if you like, living in stealth beside us, who just venture out the darkness and the tunnels and
the Darrow.
Exactly, the Darrow,
or,
yeah.
Or Lovecraft serpent people.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, where does art end and life begin?
That's right.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. So Roswell, I think, unfortunately, and again, a lot of people in ufology don't want to hear this, and I don't particularly, but I think unless, as I said, we get a definitive release of a file or files that can be forensically studied and proven to be dated from the 40s or whatever, and, you know, we have thousands of pages of the original material. Unless that happens, I really don't think we'll solve it, and it'll end up like something I've mentioned before, like Jack the Ripper. You know, everybody loves Jack the Ripper because it's a mystery, and there's dozens of books being written about it, and there will be dozens more, I'm sure, in the next 20 or 30 years. Everybody has pet theories, but there's no one to ask. Everybody's dead. And you just have researchers sitting around saying, "Oh, my theory's right. No,
yeah.
Yours is wrong." And
I kind of agree with you. It's like Roswell will evolve the same way.
Yeah.
There will never be a box we can put it in.
Not unless, as I said, you know,
yeah.
The only way I think is if a government still has files and one day it says, "Okay, enough's enough," you know. Even if it was a controversial experiment, conceivably they could come forward and say, look, everybody who's alive now, they weren't even born in 47. You know, if they release the files 50 years from now, they could say nobody in the government today was born in 47. It was nothing to do with us. It was their mishandling, and we're going to put the record straight, and, you know, don't blame us. It was another world back then.
And couldn't this be, and this is disinfo interpretation, but different, I guess, that this is a slow leak, maybe, that they're slowly, you know, through their multiple explanations, the Air Force is getting around to what you're saying, that maybe they suspect happened. Actually, there was a point in your book where you're quoting from, I forget which of the Air Force's explanations it was, but... there was, what is that quote?
Yeah, there's that many of them.
On page 30, where, let me get this right, I guess it's Cavett, the Colonel Weaver focused on Sheridan Cavett, and he stated unequivocally, however, that the material he recovered consisted of a reflective sort of material like aluminum foil and some thin bamboo-like sticks. Was that a veiled suggestion of where to look?
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's actually a good, interesting point. I mean, Cavett's a weird character.
Well, you know, bamboo-like could be balsa or basswood, which are typically used in model airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular report came out in the
was it, I think 97 or
mid, that one was 94. That one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I think again, it's like there were state. I think I'm suggesting that there's been stages where this kind of has been coming out. I really need to read John Keel's 1990 Fate article where he suggested this idea, because I don't know what evidence, if any, he presents. I had always thought he kind of did it tongue in cheek, but you were about to say about Cavett. There's a lot of interesting stories about him.
Yeah, Cavett was the one of the counterintelligence guys from Roswell, who we know was out at the crash site. Now, he said in his interview with Colonel Weaver that, you know, he recognized that it was a weather balloon. It was just a small weather balloon. The big question that Weaver never thought to ask is, well, if you were out there and you knew it was a weather balloon, why was Army Air Force Base putting out the press release saying they'd found a flying saucer?
But for that slip of the tongue, you know, why was he so keen to describe this flying disc?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the other interesting thing is that what a lot of people don't realize is that when Colonel Weaver was doing his investigation for the Air Force, which actually he was never mandated to do, what actually happened was that the General Accounting Office...
Oh, yeah, Schiff.
With Stevens, Congressman Schiff, the plan was that the General Accounting Office would approach all the agencies. They would then hand over all their files if they had some, and the GAO would find a conclusion. What the Air Force decided to do, though, was instead of answer the GAO, they would go and launch their own investigation and tell the GAO what happened. And that's literally what occurred. However, when you when you look into, for example, the Weaver report, you know, you find that, yes, they interview people like Cavett, who held up the weather balloon explanation to literally his dying day. What a lot of people don't realize, though, is that the Air Force actually prepared a statement that released any and all military personnel from any secrecy regulations they'd signed or agreed to back then. It released them from it. That's actually an official document that says, you know, if you were involved and you're involved in, you were sworn to secrecy, you are now absolved of that secrecy by the Secretary of the Air Force. Now, that suggests to me that if it was a UFO, a genuine alien craft, they wouldn't do that because they would be fearful of the truth coming out. That is another little pointer that suggests to me that maybe the Air Force today doesn't actually know and felt, you know, there was no problem. That they may actually have believed the mobile theory and thought, well, it doesn't matter if we say everybody's released from secrecy because no one's going to find anything. And also, you know, the Air Force chose to interview people like Weaver. It didn't interview some of the other equally credible military people like General Exon. You know, the Air Force didn't go to Exon and say, you know, please tell us why you believe there were bodies that were taken to Wright Field. Didn't talk to people like Bill Rickett. Granted, this was just before he died, but I mean, they didn't speak to some of the more credible people who'd made comments about seeing unusual bodies. They just went to the ones who, for the most part, talked about balloons. So, you know, it was a flawed report in that respect.
I have to say, the only other really big problem I have with body snatchers is really in some of the technical details. You talk about the crash resulting from essentially a combination of an advanced Fugo and a Horton-style lifting body. And, you know, being something of an aviation buff, I have the classic study that I think was Naval Institute Press. I don't have it with me, and I can't quote you the name of the author at the moment, but it was essentially a monograph on the Fugos.
Mm-hmm.
And I've built a couple of Horton flying wings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those, there were German technical missions to Japan during World War II. Couple of the things the Japanese were most interested in were, of course, the turbojet engine and the rocket fighter, both of which headed toward Japan on U-boats, not all of which got there, but the Japanese actually managed to completely reproduce both of the items in question from works drawings that had been sent to Germany. The thing is, these were, either Messerschmitt airframes, Walter engines, or I believe BMW turbojets. I've never run across any reference to the Japanese showing any interest in the design work of the Hortons.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll be honest with you. You know, there are a lot of questions that are still outstanding. I mean, you know, I've always said to people, all I can do is put the information out as it was related to me. The one thing I have tried to stress to people, and I'm not, maybe I didn't get this across properly in the book, was the fact that the people I spoke with said that, you know, these balloon designs that were utilized were not the original sort of 30-foot Fugo balloon bombs.
Hmm.
What they were literally huge balloon arrays, not just even single balloons, like almost in some cases like airship-type balloons with rigid, a rigid aircraft fixed below in the form of like, as you would a gondola almost, that could be, that was rigidly attached and could be detached at a certain height. Now, you know, people have said, well, that's not feasible. But then on the other hand, you know, the people I interviewed said that the whole thing was a catastrophe from start to finish and the experiment failed before it had barely got off the ground. And we know that because the thing crashed.
Yeah.
So, you know, the argument is, isn't as some people thought I was saying in the book, that this was some sort of huge advanced technology that, you know, worked wonderfully. Everybody I interviewed said, you know, the whole thing was a fiasco and a disaster from start to end, which, you know, if it wasn't seen as feasible, would arguably, you know, support what you're saying, that it isn't a feasible project, you know, which would, you know, perhaps lead to the cancellation, as the people said to me it was. They said, you know, it literally ran from sort of May to August 47 to see if they could,
mm-hmm.
you know, splice, have sort of like a hybrid device, a huge balloon array that would lift something rigidly into the air that could be detached at a certain height and flown away. And as it happened, it didn't work, and it was cancelled. But
I think the bottom line is, I thought that it wasn't so much that the Japanese had gotten that far with a supposed Horton wing, but that after World War II, we bring over the Nazis, we bring over the Japanese, and we're just like, all right, we got all this grab bag of new stuff, let's throw it together in a pot, stir it around, do a couple of different experiments here and there, combine, you know, 5-6 different experiments, you know, high altitude human experimentation, not to mention just the radiation, the nuclear propulsion, and just kind of see what sticks. Well, we're really out of time, guys. I know we weren't going to get to the bottom of this in one evening, but we gave it a try. And thank you for joining us, everybody. Nick, where can folks find out more about your writings?
Well, my website, which is nickredfern.com, that lists all the books and availability. Then I've got three blogs, ufomystic.com, which I do with Greg Bishop, which is UFOs. My cryptozoology blog is monsterusa.blogspot.com. And then I have a blog just for my Celebrity Secrets book, which is nickcelebritysecrets.blogspot.com. And I try to update them, if not every day, sort of every other day, with breaking stories and relevant material, etc. And, you know, just to get the word out, which is what we need to do to inform the public and everybody.
All right. Well, everybody, this is Smiles Lewis. And Craig York. And you've been listening to Precognitive Dissonance. Tune in next week, and we'll have Nick back in about a month, and maybe sooner if some crazy news breaks and we got to get him on to get the truth. So thanks for joining us. Have a great evening, and take care.
Thanks, guys.
See you next week.